Okay, you ready to go?
I'm ready.
All right, well, thank you for doing this today. We really appreciate it. So my name is Cassie Kirkmeyer. Today it's November 3rd, 2020, and I'll have you introduce yourself really quick.
Yes, hello. My name is Jerome Walford, and I am a illustrator and writer. And for the past few years, I've been working on developing a line of graphic novels. Inspired by some stories that I wrote very early in my interest in comic books and trying to develop those into something that's worth it being published.
Okay, awesome. So we're just going to jump right into the questions. I'm going to start with a little bit of your background personally. Could you tell me about what your community was like growing up?
So I was, well, I guess I still consider myself to be an immigrant. But my family moved to the States in 1986, and that was right before I entered high school. Having immigrated from Jamaica, I still have very strong memories of what it was like growing up there. And so I still consider myself to be very heavily influenced by my culture, by my history, and by that community that I grew up with in Jamaica. I still remember hanging out with those school friends after school and all that. But also by my formative years here in the States, I attended junior high school and high school in Brooklyn, New York. And so in that community, there was quite a mixture of those who were immigrants as well from Jamaica, from Haiti, and also those who for generations were African Americans here in the States. So on the surface, it looks like all the same, right? But there's a lot of cultural diversity within that community from those different groups.
Right. Okay, awesome. So going back to your kind of high school, young adult years, what kind of impacted you and shaped the way that you wanted your future to look like? Were there any people you met, or was it just that experience from being an immigrant, that kind of gave you ideals for what you wanted your own future to look like?
I think partly due to my parents' emphasis on education and just my own sort of geekish nature, I would say the most influential figures at that time were my teachers at school. And so I spent a lot of time thinking about how to do well in class, not just for the sake of grades, but also just how to make the most of my time there. I had some friends, that were my age, but by like many who sort of felt sort of a very complex and nuanced sense of identity as an immigrant, I always felt like I was trying to adapt or fit in, and it didn't always quite work out. But a place where I felt safe was at school in the classroom where I was able to excel by, developing really good relationships with my teachers. And so, by far, they're the most influential figures in my life at that time.
Okay, awesome. All right, so let's get into some comics here. When did comics become a part of your life, or when did you, I guess, yeah, we'll start with that question. When did they become a part of your life, and then also when did you kind of decide to make that your career?
So, again, remembering all the way back to Jamaica, I can actually remember getting hand-me-down comics from my cousins in Jamaica.
That's awesome.
And these were, we're talking about, like, if I held on to them, they'd be worth a little bit. I mean, they were ragged, definitely not mint condition, but we're talking about really early runs of the original X-Men, Spider-Man, we're talking about some really good stuff. I can remember getting those from my cousins, because they were trying to be more grown up. And so I'd read them and I would copy the figures and then I would draw my own comic books based on what I learned from reading these comic books. So even at the time when I was not in the States, I was being heavily influenced by comic books and American culture as it's interpreted through comic books.
Right.
So when I moved to the States, it was just sort of like, in a way, kind of embracing it more deeply, right? Because I was now in the States, growing up in the States, going to school in the States. And so it was just a very natural part of my childhood to occasionally, whenever I had a few extra coins to spare, I would go to the comic book store and I would buy, you know, comic books, and I would just hang out there because it was the one cool thing I could, you know, could do. And, you know, so yeah, I mean, as far back as I can remember, comic books has always been a part of my life. And so the idea of pursuing comic books was very natural to me. I even thought in high school that right out of high school, I would go right into drawing comic books and writing for comics. But my teachers thought it better for me to be a little bit wiser, a little bit more well-rounded to actually attend college. And so, you know, that became a really important part of my pursuits after high school to get a really excellent education. That being said, you know, the love for comics, for those who really love it deeply and for that long, doesn't go away. And so not too long after my career was on its way as a marketing consultant, I was doing just fine. I kind of got the rekindled passion to pursue comics. And so shortly after really thinking about it and deciding, yeah, this was totally crazy, that we're just going to go for it. And so I began to pursue, how do I turn my own original ideas into comics?
Right. That's awesome. Okay. So can you describe the first comic you made that you were really proud of? And then to go off of that, what piece of work now are you most proud of, if you can choose one?
All right. So the first comic that I'm proud of is not necessarily a professionally produced comic. It was actually one that I produced in college. And so I was a fine art major at Cornell University, and I really enjoyed that. But, you know, comics weren't cool then, you know, so no one did comics. No one drew comics, especially if you're attending university. No one's talking about it. No one really cares about it, right? That was then. Things have changed, fortunately. But as one of my projects, because I was looking for something really different to do, I came up with this comic concept about this really crazy team of quote-unquote superheroes that were very ill-equipped to take on that role. And I produced it as my final project for my communications class, and the teacher loved it. I was like, are you sure? I mean, like, it's kind of crazy. But she's like, no, this is great. I mean, I got, you know, a really excellent grade on that. And so it was one of those things that made me think that maybe I could, at some point, if I was brave enough, take the leap into comics eventually. And so essentially, my very first comic book series, Nowhere Man, is heavily based on that original concept.
Cool. Okay, awesome. So then would you say that Nowhere Man is your comic that you're most proud of now, or is it something that you can't choose? You can't really pick one that you like at this point in your life, you're like, this is my best work.
Yeah, it's tough because, you know, at a certain point you begin to realize that as you begin to explore different ideas, certainly certain things thematically really stick with you throughout your different projects, right? And so, you know, I'm proud of the different projects I've worked on for different reasons, right? Nowhere Man, I believe conceptually is a story that woke me out of that that comfort of thinking that I could just spend the rest of my life not doing comics, right? It was just this one idea that just wouldn't go away. And it kept coming back in different ways, in different formats. And the characters were just more well-rounded, more nuanced, but still the same basic concept. And what I found was that for us as writers and as artists, there are certain themes and certain figures that stick with us. And as we get older, hopefully those characters mature with us and we'll just find a better way to tell that same classic story.
Cool. Okay. Awesome. All right. So on your Forward Comics website, it states that you take readers on a journey through stories less traveled. Can you speak on the importance of telling these stories that, you know, aren't told a lot in popular media, I guess, for today? Hopefully in the future, they'll be told more, but yeah.
Well, one of the things that jumped out at me when I first decided to write and illustrate Nowhere Man was that readers tend to have a certain perception, the general reader, right? And this is a broad generalization, but I think it communicates the point that when you see a certain kind of story and when you see a certain figure in the main role, you assume a lot about the story.
Right.
You assume a lot about the kind of readership that it would appeal to. So when I produced my first trade collection of chapters from Nowhere Man, because I thought of it as an epic, but I said, let's just do three chapters and see what happens. So I produced, to the best of my ability, these three chapters that I thought were really important to how a story like this would start. And on the cover, I placed the main character, Jack McGuire, like almost life-size. So you basically just see his head and torso, and he's looking into the sky, and the background is dark, but his eyes are lit. And you can see his badge, which is around his neck, but it appears heavy, almost like a weight around his neck. When I showed it to some individuals, the immediate reaction was surprising to me. It was surprising because some of the people that saw it, particularly that were in the industry, they assumed it was like a Black story for Black people, right?
Mm-hmm.
And when you say that, or when you think that, that typically has a certain different levels of connotation. I mean, it could be a good thing, right? That's a story about a Black character that really emphasizes the importance of Black stories. That could be a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
Back then, not necessarily, right? I think that thinking can cut both ways. And so in that moment, I realized one thing that I took for granted. I took for granted this idea that a story about a Black character, about a nuanced Black experience is relatable for everyone. That was my assumption, that a story about a black character who happened to grow up in the inner city, who becomes a cop and feels the weight of responsibility of being a cop, but yet being true to some kind of moral code, would be something that everyone would say, yeah, I can see how I can relate to that. I can see how that could be important for everyone to read and know about. I think what I've learned is that, yeah, that should be something that we should be able to be comfortable with, that we should be able to say, yes, that's a great story, and everyone should be able to buy into that, right?
Yeah.
And I think what I've learned is that, first of all, it's okay for me to assume that, but not to take it for granted.
Right.
I think that's part of the learning curve for me, is that we want to be able to put out very distinctly unique stories about the Black experience, very nuanced, very, you know, astereotypical, but have a certain level of wisdom about it. When it goes out into the public sphere, everyone may or may not embrace it in the same way.
Right. Gotcha. Okay. Next question is, I read that you and your family came to America from Jamaica, as you stated. And you've made it a point in your career to tell the story of the immigrant experience through your work, Guan Anthology. Can you tell me about the process of taking that real life experience like immigration and kind of weaving that into an Afrofuturistic piece of art?
Yeah, and this is one of the reasons why I like my different projects for different reasons. I think Nowhere Man certainly was a story that woke me out of this comfort of thinking that I could pursue a path that did not involve comics, right? And it was a story about this character that, was with me for a very long time. I felt really attached to, because it says a lot about right now, but also a lot about the future, what the future could be like.
Yeah.
But also in some ways, because I'd been with the character for so long, I was so attached to him, it feels like a very individual creative process with this character and with the people around him. The Guan Anthology is very different, in the sense that it's a fictionalized version of real stories, right? Which is very different than taking a fictional story and trying to make it believable.
Right.
And so in the Guan Anthology, it's also a collaborative project. It's not just about me, it's not just about my story. It's about me telling my story in a way that's very self-contained and intimate, but then speaking to other individuals, other writers and other artists, and seeing how they can then do the same process and then have us be together in conversation, right? And so the Guan Anthology collects a wide variety of stories that are small and intimate about a very unique experience, but then brings it together in a very collaborative way, a way that shows the breadth and the relatability of each of these individual stories, because they all have this thread, this commonality that, you know, the human experience is really about this journey. We are never always in one place, you know, at least not for, you know, these days, certainly for, you know, multiple generations. We're always moving and trying to relocate and find a place that we feel more at home.
Right.
Even if that's not where we were born. And so this idea that those who go through that experience because they were forced to, or other really traumatic reasons, are somewhat separated from the spectrum of the experience of this movement towards finding a place to call home, seems a bit arbitrary and limited. So, you know, I was hoping that through the Guanyin anthology, I could sort of explore that with some very close friends and see how my experience of, you know, being an immigrant coming to the States related to their experience. And then hopefully us working together, we can say something that we thought would be very meaningful. And certainly we did at a time, and we started at a time where it was not as divisive and as a controversial issue. So it started at a point of celebrating it, right? We all have this diverse experience, but it's relatable, and sort of saying, how can we celebrate that? And now, sure enough, it's not just a celebration, it's also commentary. Mm-hmm. So that being said, you know, I've really embraced that Guanyin anthology started as being something that's very much a way to kind of get out of this solo creative process as much as possible, to collaborate with others, work with others. But also now it means a lot more. It's more than just about me and my own individual experience. It's more than just about the five friends that I pulled together. I mean, the first volume reached out to about 30 different writers and artists, many of them I didn't even know when we started the process. And so certainly the second volume built on that.
Right. Okay. Awesome. It's really cool. Let's see. I got a whole bunch of questions. I'm sifting through them.
Yeah. Sure, that's all right. Keep going.
Okay, so this question is, what do you hope people get out of reading your comics or even experiencing your artwork?
So yeah, I do feel like there are two parallel visions that are happening for comics. One is to take a fictional story and make it really believable, that it then speaks into you as the reader, that you feel like you walk away from that experience, that you were somewhat transported, you know, to an experience that is very similar to what you're experiencing right now, but shows you potentially a vision for the future, right? I mean, Nowhere Man is really all about that. It's about, how does this one singular character realize what is he meant to do right now as a result of thinking about what his legacy could be like when he's remembered in the future? That's the, to kind of give you something to kind of just unlock the keys of what the story is really about. That's what it's really about. A fictional story that is really about experience, learning how to behave now based upon your vision of what you think you'll be like in the future.
Right.
The other track, though, of the Guanyin anthology is to really explore this idea that comics is not just about great fictional stories, right? I mean, that's one way it could be used, and that's been the way that it's been used for a long time, predominantly to tell these, you know, fantastical superhero stories. But it is a literary medium that has potential way beyond that. And so the Guanyin anthology seeks to take real stories about, you know, real experiences, and then makes them just fantastical enough to lure you in, right? But with a goal to do something very different with that, right? So my hope is that if those two things could happen for our stories, whether it is in our fictional stories or our fictionalized versions of real stories, and people could sort of walk away with an experience that changes them, you know, or at least changes the way they view the world, mm-hmm. you know, I think that is the goal of those two tracks. They're very parallel, but somewhat different, but we're hoping that at some point they do meet, where right. the reader can then have an experience that they say, wow, I changed my mind. Based on what I read, I changed my mind about immigrants.
Right.
You know, I changed my mind about how I see myself as a member of society, I change my mind on those things, I'm more informed now about what that feels like for somebody else. I know what it feels like to be alienated. I know what it feels like to be separated and trying to be reconnected somewhere else.
Right.
Certainly, at least on the Guan anthologist side, which is one of our newest projects, that's the goal, to have that change of heart, change of mind.
Right. I feel like that segues well into one of my other questions, which is about Afrofuturism. So do you have your own definition of Afrofuturism, and can you define it for the people who are listening to this?
You've got some really good questions. You are prepared. I appreciate that. Thank you. I was on a video call a few days ago, and I was thinking about pitching some kind of lecture to this group. And I had to ask myself that same question. You know, when people think of the term Afrofuturism, they think Black Panther, right? I mean, because it's that expression of it is everywhere now. And that's great. That's fantastic. We owe a lot to that. But if we were to try to bring some nuance to the understanding of that term, we have to begin to figure out, how does this idea of Afrofuturism, how is it expressed in unique ways with other voices to help to build a broader picture of what that really looks like? So each of us might define it slightly differently. For me, I define it as a vision for the future that shows a definitive expression and influence by Afroculture, right? That when you look at the future and you look at interpretations of the future, you clearly see influences that come from that cultural diaspora. And when I was younger, I didn't really understand how important that is. And I'm thinking about my kids now, and when they watch the movies that they watch and the cartoons that they watch and they love it, I am glad, because they explore creativity through those things. You know, they learn new things and learn very culturally distinctive things. But the thing is that as a kid, you don't realize that those things are very culturally distinctive.
Right.
You know, when we watch, animated pieces from Japan or from elsewhere, or even from right here in the States, particularly when they're from right here in the States, we don't understand how culturally distinctive those things are. Mm-hmm. They're cultural objects, right? They're expressions of culture packaged in a way that is lovable, right? And relatable, but they are culturally distinctive, even if we don't call them that, right? So when I think about watching X-Men, you know, as a kid, or the movies that we watch now, I mean, if you were to take several expressions of pop culture that we consume today, a lot of them are very culturally distinctive. So for example, you know, hopefully not to ruin or spoil too much here, but if you were to watch Picard, for example, Star Trek Picard.
Okay.
And if you were to watch Thor Dark World. Mm-hmm. And if you were to watch The Hobbits, and if you were to watch Lord of the Rings, you know, those are all, they seem very different, right? And they are very different nuanced experiences of things that are very, very similar, right? Very, very similar and very culturally distinctive. And we can love them, but as grownups now who consume entertainment, media, we have to be more aware of how culturally distinctive those things are and begin to ask ourselves really important questions like, you know, yeah, like there's a lot of elf things going on there. Cool. That's cool. You know, there's a lot of talk about Ragnarok there. I mean, that's cool, you know. But like, you know, the world is a interconnected place, but it's also a place that's very culturally distinctive in different places, why aren't we hearing about things that are heavily influenced by African folklore, you know, or other very culturally distinctive expressions? And so this idea that we are now becoming more aware of that as adults, we can then take a step back and say, it doesn't just happen. Someone decided to produce that, right? And then how do we then give that authority, that and enable writers and artists from those cultural distinctive places to begin to share from their culture in ways that are unafraid and without apology and for everyone to embrace it to the same way. So yes, we love Black Panther because it was able to do that in a very distinctive way, but there are several others out there that could be just as lovable and relatable that need a chance.
Yep, exactly that. Okay, awesome. So I guess I'll ask you about your comics again. So what inspires you to create? And then if you want to get specific, maybe what inspired you to create Nowhere Man, since it's such a huge world, basically?
It is. It is a very big world. To kind of just sum it up, if you will, if someone's listening and they're not familiar with the Nowhere Man series, it's a story about Jack McGuire, who is a second generation police officer based in New York City, who through a series of seemingly unconnected events, he is set on a path to potentially becoming the very first superhero that ever lived. The very first one and the only one. So that being said, when you hear that, you know, again, as consumers of culture, we might begin to assume certain things, right? Or maybe we don't. But within the context of the story, I think the thing that motivates me the most about it is certainly the central character of Jack McGuire. Again, because he's a second-generation police officer, he carries on his shoulders the weight and the memory of his father, who happened to have been a 9/11 first responder. So he, in all of his choices for both good and bad, makes decisions based upon trying to honor the memory of his dad, right? And I hope that's something that we can all relate to, right? We all have kind of weird family legacies and memories to live up to and to honor. But then we also have the weight of responsibilities in the here and now that has consequences for the future. And I think that thematically at the center of it is what really drives me, because you know, when I first started writing the story and I wrote that first draft of it that I handed in, you know, with some, looking back now, some really bad illustration drawings. I mean, I was an art major, but some of those were pretty bad looking back now. I think that's what the central story was about, you know, about this deeply flawed guy who had this really one unique opportunity to do something that would change the world as we knew it. Mm-hmm. And I think that motivates me. And I think, you know, if my reader is able to hold on to that idea, no matter how weird it gets all the way throughout and twists and turns, I think hopefully by the end of it, they'll get something out of the story.
Yeah. Okay, cool. So let's see what else I can ask you. Okay, so can you talk about the importance of intersectionality in your work, if that's something that you actively think about? So including race, including gender, including Black culture, and then even like maybe if things like music or anything like that inspire you, do you think about that when you create your work? Is it something that you're like super conscious of?
Oh, that's a really great question. You know, I think the writing process is different for each writer, and the creative process is different for each artist. Mm-hmm. I know that for me, that you know, I get glimpses of the character or moment in the story, you know, that's very definitive, right? Like an interaction between Jack and, you know, and his boss, or an interaction between him and his partner, Rose Yancey. And those moments motivate me, right? Because like, I know what that looks like. I know what it feels like. I know what he says. that was probably not the right thing to say, you know, that then kind of throws things out of whack. But from the moment I start the story up until that point, sometimes I have no idea how we get there. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know what elements or what events lead up to him saying that thing or doing that thing in that moment. And between start point and that milestone is a whole series of other events that I hope is influenced by, you know, a nuance of music and other relationships that I have and interaction that I've had with others that helps to hopefully craft something that's very nuanced and very, you know, very unexpected, you know. So yeah, I do think about those convergences of identity, convergences of influences through music and current events, you know. I think about that a lot. And so yeah, I mean, I try to, like most writers do, craft some kind of arc that, you know, at least gives me some glimpse or some idea of what should happen until I get to those milestones. But until it's actually penned and penciled and inked and colored and lettered and like literally pressed, anything can happen. And so there are times when I have, you know, I said, okay, this, for example, this sequence, I need to have the dialogue down because I need for it to end in a certain way, right? I mean, that sounds reasonable. So I still do that.
Right.
I write it down. I try to be very disciplined about it. And I go through all my penciling and all my inking, and I begin to letter it. And I realize that's not really what this is about. This is about something else. And so quite often, there are moments that literally where the dialogue gets rewritten or a scene gets redrawn because, like, I realize it's really about something else. Or maybe something happens in current events that I realize, because this is a time traveling story, that we need to realize that that happened. And so that would certainly influence how the story unfolds, right? And so I try to, as much as possible, you know, to bring those elements to bear into the story, for sure.
And while we're on the topic of you writing comics and kind of your creative process, is it overwhelming creating, like, basically a whole new world? Like, is that overwhelming to you to create this huge story world that you know is going to have, like, multiple volumes and stuff like that? And is it something that you had outlined in your head while you were writing, I guess, the beginning parts of Nowhere Man? Were you like, oh, this is going to be huge? Or did it kind of just build onto itself?
Well, one thing that I've tried to do is to make sure that I sort of know where the boundaries are. So I know that this is meant to be a limited miniseries, right? So at some point it needs to kind of wrap up. Mm-hmm. And by the end of volume one, we need to be at a certain place. By the end of volume two, we need to be in a certain place as well. So that does help me a lot, because one of the things that's very challenging as a writer, as an artist, is that, you know, as long as you allow it, these stories will continue to grow and grow. And, you know, to do it well, I think you need to set some boundaries. And so thankfully that's helped me. But even within the context of that, though, you know, particularly volumes two and three, yeah, things continue to expand and grow and build in ways and go in directions that I did not anticipate. So again, not to ruin too much of the story, but there are elements that happen in volume two that I had no idea would happen, you know, or glimpses into the past that I had no idea would be important, you know. So for example, I think we spent a good chunk of time on this in the prologue of volume two, that there's a cemetery, the Greenwood Cemetery in Brooklyn, that commemorates you know, soldiers from the Civil War. Even talking about that was kind of like out of left field for me. And it's like, you know, why did that creep into the story, and how does it influence the story? And then, you know, so I spent maybe about at least a chapter on just like laying the foreshadow for that. And now that I'm actually currently producing volume 3, I now look back and think, yeah, I'm really glad I did that, because, you know, it turns out it's actually very significant to the story and to Jack's, you know, to Jack's past, if you will. So yeah, I mean, it continues to grow and continues to expand. And certainly having boundaries helps with that. But, you know, as much as possible, you want to let your stories develop a life of their own and just kind of just be along for the ride.
Right. Just falls into place and happens to be perfect, huh?
It does, right? It does. Yeah.
Okay, so we're getting towards the end of time. I'm going to ask you one last fun question, because I asked Tim the same one. Would you ever consider turning your comic works into a movie? Is it something that interests you? Is it something you've thought about? Or is it like, yeah, that would never happen?
That is the kind of the holy grail, right? I think we all would say that would be something that we would we would love to see that happen. So for me too, absolutely. I mean, I would love to see that happen. I think one thing I've learned though, because when I started this process, I was just very naive, which can be a good thing when you're starting out. Sometimes it's good to not know what you don't know. But now that I know a little bit more, you know, I understand how an extensive process that is, turning a graphic novel into a movie or some sort of adaptation. And it takes a lot of synergy and trust with a team that you hope understands where you're coming from with your vision and is able to, whether it is their licensing in that and then taking their own adaptation, which I think is, there's definitely room for that as well, that hopefully they're able to understand what the story is really, really about, right? And I think whether it is myself finding collaboration with others who would be able to bring their talents to bear onto making this happen, or someone says, Jerome, just allow us the privilege of just taking it and just trust us a little bit here to do something good with it. I think either one of those circumstances would be great, be very much an honor. But, you know, sometimes, like we're saying before, you know, sometimes you just start out with a process and then you don't know what's going to happen. You just kind of go with it and you just kind of, you know what it is? You do the best you can with what you are doing right now. You create the best story you can right now. Mm-hmm. And if it's meant to be, if that is what happens with it in the future at a certain point in time, then certainly you will have an easier time doing that if you did a really good job right now.
Right.
So at least for me, I'm hoping that I do a really good job right now, that someone will come along later on and say, yeah, this is good. Let's make a movie out of this. Yes. And they'll have an easier time.
Yeah, that was a perfect inspirational ending to this interview. So thank you so much for doing this. I really appreciate it. And I'm going to finish recording. Okay, you're off the track.